common elements and differences we've seen across these different projects. As an implementation researcher, one of the most exciting things, I think, is the role of the stakeholders in each of these projects. Parents and providers and researchers from these different countries really determining what's the best for their country rather than researchers pushing in interventions. And I think that we know that this type of collaboration is very important for implementation science across all these stages of intervention that we saw happening. I also think we saw a lot about the power of parents to change systems, to change communities, to change their homes at each of these levels, to increase access to services and the effect that has both on children and families as well as on parent empowerment in general. As well as changing the views in a culture about autism and the stigma that goes along with it. Each of these interventions involves some adaptation and some adoption, much around the structural elements of interventions, and at least for some of the interventions, less around the specific strategies that lead to change, as we see in the interventions as they're typically used. Talked about that. I think the listening to parents was the thing that was the most important across all three, as these were really parent-implemented interventions in many ways, rather than saying, here's what you're going to do, here we're the experts. There was really collaboration going on, and I think that's something we can learn from in all implementation and community settings, regardless of where they are. We also learned, and this echoes a lot of what we heard this morning in the keynote address, as well as in the special interest group around global issues, that autism really needs to be seen in the broader context of developmental disabilities as we're looking at this as internationally. So, similar to what we found in the United States when we started asking pediatricians to screen for autism, they're screening for many things in a 3-minute visit and a 12-question screening tool, someone said this morning, wasn't going to happen. And so really looking at how we can put looking for autism in the context of what is already being examined. Understanding that there is some stigma along with developmental differences, including autism in other countries. In the United States, it can often be a ticket to more intervention services, and so it can be helpful to have a diagnosis of autism. That is not the case in other places. It can be very stigmatizing or also feel very hopeless because services aren't available. And so I think that needs to be considered, as was discussed. The importance of extended family came up again and again. And again, this is often different from what we see in the United States, where families are much more nuclear. And when we take interventions to other places, especially family-implemented interventions, this really needs to be considered. Oftentimes the mother is the one being trained in the intervention, but perhaps a grandparent is the one making decisions about child raising, and this needs to be taken into consideration. And that's where the parent empowerment, especially of those mothers who may be used to taking direction, really becomes important as part of the measurement in these interventions. One of the things that I noticed when I've been to other countries and that people have talked about is that parents have a lot of common goals for their children, even among cultural differences. They want their children to be able to be happy, to be able to be successful, whether that be talking or managing the family business. They want them often to be safe and not run in the street. And they're all very busy, and so actually putting these practices into place in the context of their usual home life is a challenge no matter which country we're talking about. They all are asking for resources and help and have those barriers related to either their family context or needing to go to work or things like that. We also saw huge differences in readiness for adoption. We see this when we implement community strategies in the United States. We will see it even more as people are implementing them in more places. There are great differences in local resources and expertise. So in some cases, we had families in very rural areas with no child psychologists available. In other cases, we had individuals who'd been trained for 6 months to a year with the intervention developer and perhaps had more nearby resources to draw from. The interventions that we can choose to implement are really going to vary based on what is available in the community and who can put these interventions into place. It is very impressive in India, where parents are really putting the interventions into place themselves. Awareness of developmental delay in autism is often a first step to accessing intervention, and so figuring out how to find children and have them access the help is also an important piece. Typical developmental expectations may be different across countries, and I think we saw this in looking at the different ages and developmental functioning of the children in the different studies. When parents are noticing that there's a problem or a difference that needs to be addressed will be different in different places that we go, and it'll be important to address the differences that need to be seen in the interventions when we're identifying children at 2 versus identifying children at 6, because the intervention strategies will need to change. Infrastructure availability, crowded and hot buildings versus giant auditoriums. What's available, again, can affect whether an intervention takes place in the home, in a preschool setting, in a center-based setting, and what interventions might be most appropriate. What's the exposure to intervention strategies in general? How much background do people have? What are attitudes toward parenting, and how well do these interventions fit with those? How well do they fit with the culture and the goals? So we heard about many different kinds of interventions today. It's probable, as we're learning more about outcomes for children, that there are a lot of different ways that we can implement interventions well that lead to better outcomes for kids with autism. And so why not pick one for whatever setting that really matches the setting best? What about adaptation? So Dr. Hall talked a great deal about the critical elements of an intervention and figuring out what the strategies are that are most important. She did that by speaking with intervention developers. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of data about intervention strategies on their own, which ones are okay to kind of let go of a little bit and which ones we really need to keep and are essential. We have a lot of overlap, like I said, among these interventions, and so next steps in research might be to really identify the very key components that are important, both that are listed in interventions, but also those that aren't measured by fidelity that cross interventions, such as, you know, how good the therapist is at engaging that child. We don't always measure that, but maybe that's what's important, figuring that out so we can simplify things for better dissemination. And also those non-critical elements are the structure. How many hours a week do we need to see change? There was a lot of talk about food, which seems apropos here, where there's a lot of eating of food, I've noticed. And when it's okay for families to, for example, withhold food so a child needs to learn to talk to ask for it, and when that's not culturally appropriate. Some cultures use a lot of praising their children. Some find that not culturally appropriate. And so we've built things into some interventions, depending on what country they were developed in, that may or may not be transportable, but also may not be essential. We could look for other reinforcers that are more appropriate. And then finally, measuring effectiveness. And this was talked about a lot in the SIG this morning, about how difficult it is to use traditional measures from one country and take them to another country. So we have child outcomes to think about when we're implementing interventions. We really need to understand when they're being implemented somewhere else, what are the critical elements and what difference do they make, because they're costly and difficult. So do we see changes in these different child behaviors, and how do we measure those in a standardized way and perhaps in a way that we can communicate across different studies to help facilitate these changes? Changes in parent outcomes, which we saw measured often, that are extremely important: their satisfaction, their stress, their confidence in using the intervention, and their empowerment. Also, measurement of implementation. So how are the interventions being adapted? We won't know unless we measure that. And then what are the effects of those adaptations? Do they facilitate the children's and parents' outcomes because we've matched the intervention to their culture? Or are they diluting those outcomes because we've lost a critical element? These are essential factors for us to figure out as we're moving interventions to new places. What are the core components that are needed? And what is needed to sort of set the frame for implementing a particular intervention? Many of the interventions we talked about today really need a good understanding of child development. Do the interventionists have that information, and is it the same as we're moving? Does the curriculum that comes with that intervention match what's needed for children in that country? And then finally, looking at long-term sustainability. If an intervention is implemented, how much training is needed, and how long does coaching need to take place, and how can we keep things going in the absence of abundance of funding, which is always a problem everywhere, and how can we facilitate more people becoming experts as we go. Okay. So finally, I want to just highlight collaboration as the key to moving forward in all of these areas. Figuring out generalizable models of how to adopt and adapt interventions that can be moved, so not to take the intervention and use it in the same place every time, but what are some models we can use to adapt the intervention effectively, and then measures and outcomes for constructs. And so now we'd like to think about if you have any questions for any of the panel members. I think we have a few minutes. Sam, have a question?
Could you comment on changes that you saw in terms of the shame associated with the disability over the course of your projects?
Yeah, I think that the other side of shame is acceptance. And so acceptance is, as I mentioned, one of the explicit goals of the training program. The examples that we saw of change in acceptance, which again I see as sort of the flip side of shame, parents who talked about I'll give you one example, then I'll give you a separate one. A mother who remarked that she was walking by a school and with her son, and the stranger said, "What is this school?" It was a special school, and she said, "It's a school for children with autism." And she said that this was an example of not being ashamed of her son, not being able to accept that her child had autism, and being willing to say it to a stranger. So that's one example. I think another example would be that within the family, there is often a lot of experience that the mother is the one who is responsible for this. And so what we're seeing, the comments from the moms during their 5-minute speech sample, which we're doing at the at all of the time points, is that there is a lot of sense that they now are able to tell their family members that, no, he has autism, that's why he's like this, it's okay, we love him anyway, everything is going to be okay. So those are just a couple of examples off the top of my head.
Yeah, I think shame is a big issue in Morocco too. And I think, of course, what Tamara said, that the parent empowerment is very important. And what was also important, I think, is that we did things in collaboration with other people. For instance, the picture that I showed you, that we made something in the street with other people willing to help, and we showed it to the parents too. And actually, especially among mothers, then sometimes you have this atmosphere where they are laughing about it. And I think that the joy that you can have when you have a parent group is very important for reducing shame. And especially also because then they were telling others, and the workshops that other people came in, I think it helps a little bit to diminish shame. But on the other hand, we had one of the children that was completely dropped out of the follow-up of the study, and I think that has mainly to do with shame, not only for the outside world, but inside the family. So it were the aunts, uncles, other people in the family saying, well, you know, this was nice for 3 weeks, but what's the need of this program for the rest of the life for your child?
Thanks. First, I want to congratulate all the speakers because these are great presentations and just really innovative. And I wish it had been earlier in the conference so many more people would have been here and filled up this hall. One of the things that occurred that sounded very familiar about the PCTP program was how involved the parents were in the actual training parts of the program. So there was, in the U.S., when we were first beginning to work in early intervention, there was a program in Nashville, Tennessee, called the Regional Intervention Project that that ran on a shoestring budget and was free to parents and was able to run because parents were so engaged in actually doing the training. So the parents learned about the program and then became trainers of other parents in the program. So that, to me, reflects kind of, I think, an empowerment dimension that you talked about. And also, it seems like a very central part of the PCTP program. And I'm wondering if Dr. Stamer talked about how there are programs are made up of many features, components, elements. I think we have a unique opportunity because two of the program developers, Mary Barua, and I know I pronounced her name wrong, and Dr. Karzlan, actually developed those programs. So I'm wondering if they would be willing to talk about, or just say a word or two about what they think are the key features that actually led those programs to happen. Is that possible?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Can you all come up and talk for a minute?
Take the mic.
I can bring a microphone down too.
I don't think we can carry the.
Yeah.
And Sam, what, could you just repeat again what the key component that you
wanted
to...
So I was wondering, I hate to take over and step into as an MC, but I was wondering if they could talk about what they think the key features of their program were to that led to parent empowerment and positive outcomes. So there.
Hello, I am Özcan Karaslan from Turkey. I want to explain, my language is not enough, but I want to do my best. Actually, all parents, when I started to responsive teaching, conducting in Turkey, they couldn't follow the child's lead firstly because they told me that we got used to every time teach something to the our child. Maybe this affects when we go to the school or when we make meeting about our child with the, our child's teacher. They every time direct us, you have to teach something. When I want to play with my child, I have it every time begin to teach something, not just playing. And that's why I couldn't focus on my child's interests. In responsive teaching, that's why I am saying I begin to change the order of strategies. For the, and then I give solution. You can begin with imitate your child's actions and what he or she said, and parents begin to imitate his child's or her child's. Then they recognize I begin to follow my child's lead, and the other thing is when the child's and parents come together, and some of most of my parents have low social economical level. That's why at their home they couldn't find enough toys, and I give some solutions when they go to the, for example, kitchen. Then you can use some of your kitchen's utensils, and you can interact by using these utensils with your child. And parents told me when we use every part of home like this, you gave me these examples, then we become successful. The other thing is, parents told me when we interact with our child, we enforce to us, for example, at least 1 hour, I couldn't interact with my child. Can I divide it to our time? For example, 5 minutes I interact, then I can rest. Maybe this should be better for me. They reported to me. Actually, I have much more reporting, parent report, but I can summarize like that. I can share maybe after this session. Thank you very much.
I'm Mary Barua, and I think you got my name quite right. And if I understood the question, it was, what was it that led us to start the program? In India, when, 20 years back when we started, the general perception was that parents cannot do anything to help the child. They have to depend on professionals. So there was this mystification of professional expertise that parents were supposed to be incapable of ever having. And in a country of a billion, which is what we are, it would be impossible to ever have to be able to help all families with the kind of services that would be considered ideal. I think that was really one of the first things that one had started thinking of in the mid-90s. As the work evolved, one realized that when parents had the knowledge and the information, they became change makers. And in order to bring about change, and in India at that time one needed to bring about a lot of changes, which one needs even now to do, that's how the whole idea of getting parents empowered to bring about the change that we wanted to see happened. And when the program had initially started in 2001, I was still thinking in terms of, like maybe helping the parent get some information and get empowered. We're still kind of, like Tamara said, it's an evolving program. And then over a period of time, one realized that it is about, of course, giving them information, but more about helping them change their perceptions, because once they change their perceptions, as Tamara said a while back, it helped change the whole concept of stigma. It helped them to be able to stand up. We were talking about multi-generational families yesterday at the discussion. And that's something that is very common in India as well. For parents, for a mother particularly, to be able to stand up in a positive way to a mother-in-law or a father-in-law or extended family and say, or to convey in some manner that I know what I'm doing and is the best for my child. To take that kind of stand. It's not easy in a country like India, which is extremely patriarchal, which is very traditional, and where the mother is expected to follow rules, and where a child with a disability is considered the end of the world. So for a situation like that, to help parents and particularly mothers to be able to stand up and deal with such situations, change these situations, help their child, and in the long term perhaps change policy, people, society. That I think really was what was behind the whole thing. I hope I was a bit clear. Thank you.
Any other questions? Oh, right up there.
Thank you. A comment and a short question, and actually the question is for Mary, not for the panel. But to the panel, also I want to add congratulations, and I think this is the first educational symposium put together by the Cultural Diversity Committee, am I right? So well done on that. So I think that all was supported in that. So. My comment is particularly aimed at Marijke, but I think it applies to us as a whole organization. You were very apologetic about not having numbers and kind of made up some. But I was very struck that at the conference we had very little qualitative research. And particularly the kinds of things we're talking about here and many other aspects relating to autism really can benefit from much more qualitative research. And I would really like us to have and think about further, improving our qualitative research in this kind of society that tends to be have a very cultural bias towards quantitative research. So again, don't apologize, you've all presented lots of very rich data. So finally, my little question to Mary, which is, Mary, I was very interested in your program, but 12 weeks of time for a family to come sounds like a lot of time. And number one, how do people in India respond to coming to you for 12 weeks? And how do you think that can be translated into other environments? Because it feels to me like a lot of time for people to take out of whatever else they're doing in their lives.
You're right that 12 weeks is a very long period of time, but we felt that that was the amount of time that was really needed, because there were a lot of things that one had to do. One had to get the parents to be comfortable around the child, learn to be comfortable about the behaviors, because if that does not happen, that is a part of the whole empowerment process. And it's not something that can be done very fast. It needs time. When the program had started, it was with only families from around Delhi, people who could travel down. And you know, in India, in Delhi particularly, one is used to traveling for a couple of hours to get to a program if need be. So it was meant for people in Delhi only. But what one found is that we don't advertise in any way. It's purely word of mouth. And people come. And I think what happens is that when a family meets another family that and they see what has happened with the child and how the family has changed and how the family dynamics sometimes have changed, I think that makes them come and want to do the training. And I think this is true of families everywhere. And I want to give one quick example. This is not to do with the PCTP. Many years ago, I had gone and stayed when my son had... I have a son with autism too, who's 32 years old. He'll be 33 in a few months' time. I had gone to stay somewhere in South India, where I heard there was a program. It wasn't a program for autism, but 28 years ago, since there was nothing else, I had gone and stayed. It was a very basic program. I lived in a tiny 8x9 room. I had to, you know, stay there, cut off from my family with my son. And I did it because I thought, let me give it a shot. And the amazing thing was, in that program, in some of the other rooms, there were various families who had also come. And I still remember, and I think that was one of the things that that period that left a huge impact on me. One mother who I became friendly with was a daily wage laborer. I don't know if you all understand what that is in the U.S. A daily wage laborer, meaning she had to go out and work every day to earn a small wage. She had given up her daily wage to come and live for 3 months to learn what to do with her child. And I know now that child had a diagnosis of intellectual impairment, but I know now with my knowledge that the kid also had autism. So I think parents sometimes do things that they feel would eventually help their child or themselves, the family, etc. And I think that's what drives parents to come, and sometimes parents come. When this little study was started, because of the need to have, families, you know, we had to plan it well, we had to know how many families there were going to be there. So therefore, I think some of the families that we usually get are not there in this project period. Otherwise, we do have families who have very little resources. We have a system of sponsoring some families. And I don't think there were any sponsored families. I don't think we had any sponsored families in this. There were. So we do have families who really don't have the resources who come because they feel they will get something out of it. And it doesn't matter if it's too much. They will still come because it's going to help my child, because it's going to change things around for my child and my family. Families will do that. And I think when you come from a country like ours, you do it more because things are not there. And I think that's perhaps one of the differences.
One last question. Here comes your microphone.
Hello, I'm Elizabeth Gray from North Carolina, and we've just started doing some work with some parent groups in Bolivia. And yet, one of the things that we've been hearing, and I was struck by you folks, is that we've been encouraged to work with some of the government ministries and begin to build some infrastructure or help them build some infrastructure. So I noticed these are programs that haven't gone that route. Can you talk about that as a choice, or was it a choice?
Well, in the case of Morocco, that was the choice of the parents, actually. So it was not necessarily my choice, but it was the parents who said, well, we want the government to be aware of our needs and we want them to do something. But if we have to wait for them, it will not benefit my child. So that was the reason for us to support them in their request. And at the meantime, try to do something to find a connection with the university, to find a connection with the government. But it was also my experience that that is a lot slower than parents are. So I think that it is a good way to build now on the parent initiative and then to try to get governmental organizations and other organizations interested. And I can't blame these organizations because there's so much work to do. It's not only autism that they are dealing with. So I understand it, but I also understand the parents very well who say, we want something now, so please don't wait for the government. So.
Thank you to our fabulous speakers and all of you for staying so nicely late.